Much of Iowa and other Midwestern states are very windy, and that wind has power. But one of the great challenges of the wind energy industry has been connecting that power to the grid. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll hear about the Rock Island Clean Line, a project to deliver 3,500 megawatts of wind power from Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Minnesota to communities in Illinois and states to the east. Then we'll find out about new rules from the Federal Communications Commission that are bound to play a major role in economic development across Iowa. That's all coming up this hour, right after a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We all know that much of Iowa and other Midwestern states are very windy, and that wind has power. Iowa is one of the nation's leaders in wind energy generation, but connecting that power to the grid has always been a challenge of the wind energy industry. This first half hour, we want to discuss a project that tackles that challenge. It's called the Rock Island Clean Line, and it is planned to deliver 3,500 megawatts of wind power from Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Minnesota to communities in Illinois and states to the east. And it does this by means of a 500-mile high-voltage transmission line from northwest Iowa to Illinois. Joining us this first half hour to discuss this project, Hans Detweiler. He is Director of Development for the Rock Island Clean Line. Hans, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben. Pleasure to be here.
So this is a project that should help connect more of the wind-generated electricity in our state to the power grid, to move it to clients outside of Iowa, to areas that have a strong demand for clean, reliable power. Give us a better idea of what's involved in this project.
Well, it's a very long-term project, and it's a project where we really are reliant on the input of many stakeholders all across the states of Iowa and Illinois. So we're very pleased that the project is in Iowa and Illinois because we found a very warm reception in both of those states. And so I mean, really what you're doing with a project like this is you're taking a product, wind energy, and you're trying to deliver it to a market where it has real value, and value in a couple of different ways, both just for bulk energy, but also because it's clean energy, and a number of states have requirements that they use renewable energy in certain percentages. And then also you're looking for a route that truly minimizes the impact to the maximum extent on all of the landowners that you would be traversing as you go. And so you really need a very extensive process as you chat with people. So we've done several series of open houses all across Illinois and Iowa, where we've invited everybody from local county supervisors, county elected officials, to actual direct landowners, to members of local conservation groups, farm bureaus, all those sorts of folks, to come out and give us feedback on areas where the impact of the transmission line might be less and areas where it might be more. And mm-hmm. So that help has really been very valuable as we've been working on the route.
I understand this represents a $1.7 billion investment over how many years?
That's correct. It's $1.7 billion investment just for the transmission lines. Now, our company is an independent transmission line company, so that's separate from the estimated $7 billion of wind farm development that would occur in the northwestern corner of the state. In terms of when that development would occur, as I mentioned, it's a lengthy process to figure out exactly what your route is. We plan to file in Illinois for the approval of the route this year, and we'll file in Iowa. We plan to file next year, and we expect that approval will take 18 months to 2 years in each of those states, and then we would finance construction and begin construction. So you'd be looking at construction beginning in 2014 to 2015 and continuing to being placed in service and fully operating in 2017.
So who has has these billions of dollars to invest?
Well, so our owners, we're lucky to have a good set of owners, is ZBI Ventures, which is a family associated with the Ziff brothers, who were well known in publishing. They got out of publishing a while ago. So they are high net worth individuals who have a very long view of the energy needs for our country. And so they are willing to support our project with the development costs that will go for some number of years. Now, after we actually get our regulatory approvals and our financing construction, it's very likely that other investors would step in and play a part, other infrastructure funds and things like that. That's typically how very large transmission projects are built, not with just one investor as the owner of the project.
Hans Detweiler is with us, Director of Development for the Rock Island Clean Line, a project we're talking about this half hour. If you have comments, questions, concerns, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. A lot of investment here. Do the numbers for us. We're not economists here, but can you roughly do numbers for us? Considering the price of wholesale power today, does this make economic sense?
Yeah, so our project, we believe, makes strong economic sense based on a number of factors. One of them, as you mentioned, is just the wholesale price of power. That relates to prices for coal and prices for natural gas. But it also relates to state renewable portfolio standard requirements and different pieces of federal policy that are out there, everything from the production tax credit, about which there's been much discussion, to the potential for a federal renewable portfolio standard, to also the US EPA's regulations on coal plants and fossil fuels in general. So what you need to do to figure out if a project like this makes sense is look at all of those things, and not look at all of those things today, but look at all of those things based on when you're going to be placed in service, which, as I said, we anticipate would be 2017. And so when you combine all of those things together, then there's a pretty strong business case for the project.
Mm-hmm. But what if that price doesn't go up? Won't natural gas be then a better alternative, more economical? We have years now that we've got these new technologies, years and years of cheap natural gas, don't we?
So I don't have a crystal ball on exactly where natural gas prices are going to be, and I think I'm not alone in that category. I've been pleased to see my home heating bill go down the same way lots of other Midwesterners have been pleased to see that happen over the last couple of years. So I think that's one factor that's out there, but I would really stress that Illinois, for instance, has a law that requires that 25% of its total electricity supply come from renewable resources by 2025, and Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Maryland and Delaware and Ohio all have similar laws and use an enormous amount of power. And what the Rock Island project accomplishes by delivery into Illinois is Northern Illinois is in the same grid operator region. I won't try and get too wonky here, but the electric grid operator for that region of the country spans from Northern Illinois through New Jersey. And most of the states in that area, their renewable energy requirements simply say that, well, you have to be in PJM or delivered, that's the name of the grid operator, or delivered into their region. And so our project would facilitate that. And so for the first time, wind from resources in western Iowa, which are far more cost-effective than any wind resources anywhere within that grid operator region, would be eligible to meet the New Jersey and Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, Ohio standards. And so that piece of value, what is the value of states meeting their requirements for renewable energy, is equally important with whatever the price of natural gas may be in the future. And, you know, as I mentioned, the other pieces in terms of what federal policy is going to be out there. Will the production tax credit look pretty much like it looks today? Will it be different? What's the policy on coal plants? All those things.
Of course, policies, laws, regulations, guidelines can all be changed because they're created by public servants by politicians. And as we know, this wind energy thing has become quite a political football. Let's talk about what you just mentioned. As delegates to the Republican National Convention prepare to meet in Tampa, Florida, the party platform has dropped the federal wind power tax credit from its policy goals. GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney does not support the tax credit. And here's what he had to say about wind energy at a Zanesville, Ohio campaign rally.
What is his energy policy? It's apparently to make it hard to get coal out of the ground with more regulations, hard to use it, hard to take advantage of our oil resources, makes it harder to get the gas out of the ground. And as a result, why he's happy with wind and solar. We all like wind and solar, but you can't drive a car with a windmill on it. And my plan is that we're going to get America finally energy secure by taking advantage of our coal, our oil, our gas, and bringing in that Keystone pipeline from Canada.
President Obama has campaigned in Iowa saying the wind energy tax credits are critical to supporting a growing industry.
And guess what? Governor Romney said, let's end the tax credits for wind energy production. Let's get rid of them. He said that new sources of energy like wind are imaginary. His running mate calls them a fad. During a speech a few months ago, Governor Romney even explained his energy policy this way. I'm quoting here, you can't drive a car with a windmill on it. That's what he said about wind power. You can't drive a car with a windmill on it. Now, I don't know if he's actually tried that. I know he's had other things on his car.
Now, the tax credit is set to expire on January 1st. That is, unless there is an extension, something that puts Governor Romney at odds with some Republicans here in Iowa, including Republican Congressman Tom Latham.
The wind energy folks have come out and said, listen, we're willing to have a phase out, you know, 5-7 years, whatever it is, and you know, whatever we can get an agreement on to phase it out as the industry matures. My problem is simply that the immediate cutoff or the cliff will be very, very harmful as far as a lot of the businesses that have developed here in Iowa. There's about 250 businesses, about 41, 42 manufacturing facilities here. I just think we differ, you know, as far as a phase out that I would support. You know, eventually we've got to, if we're ever going to balance a budget, obviously we have to look at everything. I wish that they would have said, let's include this in overall comprehensive tax reform next year, along with oil and gas and all the other credits and deductions that are out there, rather than just a single out wind.
Iowa Republican Congressman Tom Latham, before that President Obama, and to start off, Mitt Romney, Governor Mitt Romney. Now let's take up that point, Hans Detweiler, Director of Development for the Rock Island Clean Line. Are you willing to, as Tom Latham said, willing to see a phase out of the tax credit?
So I think it's all a matter of context. Like a lot of people in Iowa, I've also spent time in my career on the biofuel side. And on the biofuel side of things, the former VTEC credit for ethanol went away, and it hasn't really caused too many problems. And part of the reason it hasn't caused too many problems is because the renewable fuel standard is in place and took care of that. So I think that one of the things that some people who are looking at the federal policy question are asking themselves is should we also have a federal renewable electricity standard? And in fact, the federal renewable electricity standard has passed the House in some years, and it's passed the Senate in other years. It's never passed both houses in the same year, but it has passed both of them. And as I mentioned earlier in the discussion, it is already the law in 29 different states around the country. And
so
if you have a situation where you ramp down and the production tax credit goes away and it's replaced by a renewable electricity standard or some other sort of policy, then I think that might make a lot of sense, and it might, it certainly from the federal budgeting perspective would be much easier on the federal budget. I think what you can't have is you can't reasonably have an expectation that at a time when the federal government has permanent in law, policies in place that support the nuclear industry and permanent policies that support oil and permanent policies that support coal. You can't expect wind energy to be the only resource that doesn't have any federal policy support and have it expect to compete and survive and thrive in that sort of an environment.
What happens, Hans Detweiler, if this tax credit is allowed to expire? Boom, it's done.
So I think that for, as some of your, as Congressman Latham mentioned, that for some of the manufacturers that are in Iowa, that would be devastating. And in fact, you know, based on the lack of orders for next year, 2013, many of the manufacturers are already beginning layoffs. So folks like Clipper, which manufactures the turbine, the main piece at the top, in Cedar Rapids, it's problematic for them. I think they're looking at layoffs.
Right. They announced that this past week. That was the news, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're saying that's tied directly to this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's no market in 2013 for wind. Now part of that is, and here's something people should think about, is the federal production tax credit for wind, it has always been extended for some number of years instead of being something that's permanent. And so people always know that there's an expiration date that's coming, and so developers always focus on those expiration years as years where they have to get stuff built. And so what we've seen in the past is even barring an actual expiration, just the fact that an expiration was scheduled before it was renewed has meant that the year of the expiration was a huge boom and the next year was a big bust because everybody already built everything sort of planning on the next year also.
Hans Detweiler, I want to throw out the number again in case someone wants to get in on our conversation as we wind up here in the next 5 minutes, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org.
So just to stress a point there. So what I'm really trying to say is the federal government needs to do something, and the federal government should find something that's long term and stable. And I think that's what everybody would support. Now, our particular project, looking at 2017, what happens in tax policy in 2013 isn't super relevant to us.
So what are you doing in regards to influencing any of those policy decisions on the tax credit?
We absolutely, we talk to our senators and representatives the same as everybody else in the wind industry is doing, and we strongly support that. But we're truthfully a relatively small company. We've got fewer than 40 employees, and we're working hard on developing projects like the one in Illinois and Iowa. So, what we can do to move the needle other than, chatting with people about it is pretty limited.
Okay, let's go to Linda in Iowa City who's been listening. Linda, just a few minutes left. Please make it short. What's on your mind? Linda in Iowa City, are you there? Linda, can you hear me?
Hello?
Yes, Linda, we can hear you. Go ahead. Not much time left. Go ahead with your question or concern.
I manage some farmland for my parents in northern Iowa, and I wondered when will landowners up there be contacted? What kind of advance warning will we get? What kind of information can we get, can we contact ahead of time? What's the impact going to be?
Linda, that's a great question. So Iowa law is actually very clear on these sorts of things. So what we will do is we will work with the Iowa Utilities Board to schedule a round of informational hearings. There will be an informational hearing in every single county that we traverse with the project. We will send written notifications to every landowner in the county, telling them along the route, telling them about the informational meetings that we'll be doing. And there will be, full time for a presentation by us on the project. We'll make public the route and all of the details of the route. We'll take questions and deal with things in detail. Then following that, we will make any adjustments based on the feedback that we get from people as to what the best route should be, and we will then commence with some amount of of easement acquisition. We'll go out and start talking to landowners and negotiating to acquire some of the easements. And then we will file the route with the Iowa Utilities Board. Again, everybody will be notified that we've actually filed the route. All the landowners will be notified. And then any landowner that wishes can then intervene in that process, which means formally participate in that process at the Iowa Utilities Board. So there will be, you know, years worth of process and opportunity for landowners to get their questions answered.
Do you anticipate years of you know, court action too? There's some of these people are not going to agree with their land being taken in potential use of eminent domain. That has to be figured into the plan as well, right?
So we hope to avoid that if at all possible. What we've seen from other similar projects that are long projects in terms of eminent domain is that where it's really necessary is where you've got estates that are in probate and you really don't even know for certain who owns a parcel. You don't have any choice but to use eminent domain as a process to do that. You also get some absentee landowners who just flat out don't respond. So we think that will be most of the instances where we need to use eminent domain. You know, at the same time, we're going 500 miles. We're certain that we will bump into some people who
right.
don't like the
project. And you want it more or less a straight shot. I mean, with the cost of this line, you can't be zigzagging all over the landscape, can you?
Well, it's not only that's correct. Not only because of the cost of the line do you not want to zigzag, but also just because the impacts on farmers are much greater if you're zigzagging as well. So okay. Our interests and farm interests are the same as far as that goes.
Perhaps we could wind up by having you tell us, besides obviously the people who receive the power and produce the power, what are some of the benefits for Iowa and Iowans in the remaining minute or so we have of this conversation that people might not think of?
Sure. Well, I think the primary benefits are you'd have approximately $7 billion worth of new wind farm construction in the northwestern part of the state. That would be a great source of long-term jobs. We would estimate approximately 500 permanent jobs in the O&M from the wind farms and a little bit on the transmission line as well. Those wind farms would contribute to the tax bases, and that benefit is very well known in Iowa. Our transmission line itself would pay a property tax through what's called the replacement tax of $7,000 per mile per year, so local governments would get the benefit of that as well. There are the manufacturing benefits that we talked about, where companies like Clipper and Axiona and Siemens and many other companies all across the state are benefiting from the wind industry and would be supported by a project like that. And then finally, the environmental benefits. I mean, the amount of carbon that would be reduced by this project would be roughly the equivalent to 20% of Iowa's electric carbon dioxide levels per year. So,
okay. Very quickly, before we have to go, we've really got literally 20 or 30 seconds for this. Some might ask, well, why not keep the power here in Iowa? Only a certain small percentage of our power is generated by wind, even in this state. Why do we have to transport it all the way to Illinois?
Well, Iowa already leads the nation in the amount of wind energy, and just as Iowa exports corn and exports soybeans because it produces more of it than it can use and exports ethanol for that matter, in the same way with wind, the amount of wind resource potential in Iowa is many, many multiples of what can be used in the state. So a project like ours facilitates that export market in the exact same way that railroads and barges okay. and others have exported other Iowa commodities for generations.
Hans Detweiler, thank you very much. Director of Development for the Rock Island Clean Line. Where's the contact people can go to find out more on the web?
www.rockislandcleanline.com.
Thank you, Hans Detweiler.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll find out about new rules from the Federal Communications Commission, FCC rules that are bound to play a major role in economic development across Iowa. That's when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, Director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program, Christopher Merrill, we'll explore the nature of terror, what's its place in our post-9/11 world. How does terror unite and galvanize those in the throes of it? Christopher Merrill will be with us. He'll take us comment about what the subject of his new book, covering exotic journeys to Malaysia, China, the Dead Sea, and war-torn Syria in his new book. Merrill was recently appointed by President Obama to the National Council on Humanities. The Global Impact of Our Age of Terror, tomorrow on this program with Christopher Merrill. New rules from the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, went into effect on July 1st. They are rules that are going to play a major role in economic development across Iowa. Now, local telephone companies are still assessing the full impact of these new rules, and providers are working to ensure affordability and minimum disruptions in delivery of reliable broadband services to consumers and businesses in Iowa's rural communities. Joining us now to discuss what these new rules are and what they mean for us as consumers, first of all, Mark Wigfield. He's a spokesperson for the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. Mark, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Two terms I'll throw out, and you'll tell us how these are differ. Prior to July 1st, we had the rule, something called Universal Service Fund and now Connect America Fund. Tell us about the rule prior to July 1st and now, how they differ.
Okay, the Universal Service Fund was a fund that was used to ensure that all of rural America had access to affordable phone service. And it worked very well in the 20th century to basically make sure that all those connections were made across rural America. But as broadband has become more and more important to us in our daily lives, whether it be looking for a job, whether it be connecting your small business to a global market or a national market, whether it be educating your children, doing a correspondence course, we realized that universal service was simply not up to the task to expand broadband to all of rural America.
Without getting too technical, why not? Why the change? What's going on?
So the universal service system was not geared to accurately target support to areas where broadband was lacking. So what's happening right now is we are taking a look at where broadband is lacking, and trying to use the fund in a way to reach those areas. For example, the Connect America Fund, the first phase, kicked in just this summer, and this was an initial infusion to areas that were really lacking in service, where with some additional support they could get service. So, in Iowa, CenturyLink has accepted $1.9 million to provide broadband to 2,400 locations that do not have service now. And of course, this is just the first phase. The next phase we see over the next 7 years, we expect to serve an additional 7 million people over the next 6 years, and then by the end of the decade, the entire nation.
Mark Wigfield is a spokesperson for the Federal Communications Commission, joining us this half hour. Your comments, your thoughts, your questions, 1-866-780-9100. Joining our discussion, Don Jennings, Executive Vice President of Partner Communications Cooperative. That's a company which provides phone, internet, and cable service to some small communities in central Iowa, State Center, Baxter, Melbourne, Rhodes, Kellogg, Gilman. Don Jennings, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You've heard a description from Mark Wigfield of the new rules. How has this new rule affected your company thus far?
Well, our industry certainly was in support of reforming the Universal Service Fund. But we feel like the new rules have implemented some uncertainties in the revenue model that we operate under that's creating some question as to our ability to move forward with deploying broadband services. Our company took the Chairman Jenikowski's challenge of 100 squared back in 2010, 100 megabits to 100 million homes. Seriously, and we're cooperative. We serve members that own our company, and so we submitted a loan application to the USDA and secured a rural utility service loan to deploy fiber to the home. And we're in the third year of a five-year build-out plan, and because of the significant changes created through the order, we've had to stop construction and wait to reevaluate our ability to go forward. So we feel that some of the changes have come about too quickly, and we also think that we need to step back as a industry and take a look at where we're at, take our breath before we move forward with any other actions. And again, the order has several different parts to it. So
let's get a reaction to that, Don Jennings from Mark Wigfield. So here's a company, Mark Wigfield Partner Communications Cooperative. They're abandoning building plans for their multi-year plans for fiber cables in small towns, rural areas of the state. That wasn't the intention, was it?
Well, Partner, in fact, gets about $382 a line per year in support per line. We basically see there will be, based on our numbers, Partner won't see any change in support over the next few years. In fact, they should see a slight increase over the next year. And statewide, out of 149 Iowa carriers, we think that 4 will see a reduction in 2012 and maybe 11 in 2014. So the overall support to the small Iowa carriers, the rate of return carriers, increases slightly each year from 2012 to 2014. So we think that we are continuing to invest over $2 billion annually into the smaller communications companies across the country for broadband. So we feel that in addition, there have been no flash cuts, any changes are phased in. So we think, and of course we work with carriers all the time.
Are you saying then, Mark Wigfield, that there are no casualties, no downside for telecommunications for companies here in Iowa like Partner Communications Cooperative?
Let me put it to you this way. The important thing is that all Americans have access to broadband and phone service, and no American will lose access to broadband or phone service because of these changes. There have been some companies under the current system that have been overcompensated, that get too much. We have instances of companies getting $19,000 a line in support. We have instances of companies getting universal support when they have a competitor that has no subsidies. We have instances of companies that receive universal service support, but then they pay dividends to their cooperative shareholders based using those subsidies. So we feel that in some sense, some companies will have to do some belt tightening, but this is also an issue for consumers, because consumers pay an assessment on their phone bills every month for the Universal Service Fund or for the Connect America Fund. So we have to keep in mind that there's not limitless money, that we don't want to pinch consumers and small businesses with high fees, and we need to distribute this money in a fair way so that everyone has access to basic broadband, which is, by our calculation at this point in time, about 4 megabits per second.
4 megabits per second is how you define broadband.
That's correct, and a 1 megabit per second upload. And, of course, that standard will change as time as technology progresses.
Don Jennings, your reaction to Mark's comments?
We've certainly blown past 4 megabit as a basic broadband services in Iowa as far as the demand goes. But going back to the numbers that were referenced earlier in Mark's comments, the universal service funding that we receive is for construction investment from 2010. So it actually runs 24 months in arrears, the way the system works. So those dollars are plant that's in service and in the ground serving customers. It doesn't reference the ability to predict revenue streams going forward for capitalizing additional construction. And that's the real uncertainty that we're going through as an industry, because the new reform rules and the way that things have been established, it's very difficult to let's say submit a 5-year build-out plan when you don't know what your revenues are going to be for 18 months from where you're at right now. So that's part of the dysfunction that's been taking place in the revenue model.
Okay. Don Jennings, hold on, please. We want to introduce into our conversation Brian Schultz, founder and owner of a new marketing company called Opposable Thumbs, located in your area, Don, in State Center. Brian Schultz, welcome to our program.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to this conversation. What's your take on this? How does it affect you?
Well, you know, I have a tech-based business. Everything I do is online, so I definitely have a vested concern in what's going on, and more particularly because I'm in the marketing field. My entire business model is based on the growth of Iowa's rural economy, because those are the businesses I mainly serve. And with without broadband, we are I'm really uncertain about the growth of my company.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that what strikes me is very interesting in the entire conversation about rural broadband is Iowa is has a farm-to-market road system that is the envy of the nation, and it should be. And at one time, we invested in our infrastructure because we recognized the need for our rural producers to get their goods to market, which would benefit the entire economy. I think we're facing the exact same issue today with ensuring that we're investing in a new, if you will, digital farm-to-market system. And it's really incredibly important that internet equality occurs to keep our rural economies thriving.
But what are you saying about this switch, this Universal Service Fund to Connect America Fund? What is your take on that right now?
Well, my take on it is I feel it's an attempt to drive consumers' choices to larger companies, to be frank. And as a consumer, I'm going to trust my cooperative, which is made up by local owners, rather than a large company that, let's face it, if major carriers had wanted to serve rural America, they would have done it by now. I'd rather see that my choice remains mm-hmm. local with people who have a vested interest in our communities.
Well, it sounds like a worthy goal, Mark Wigfield. What about that? Does this new goal, this new rule? Advantage, give larger companies an advantage and put at a disadvantage smaller cooperatives like Partner Communications Cooperative?
No, it doesn't. This system really increases fairness, you know, for all consumers and all small businesses, because, you know, it's important that broadband networks be ubiquitous, that Mr. Schultz's company can reach small businesses in counties like, if he's doing a web-based business, in Winnebago County, Iowa, which has currently 65.4% of the rural population in Winnebago County is actually not served by broadband, or Davis County, which is 64%. We have a very high rate. Iowa has done a better job than the nation as a whole in terms of the rural population. 24% of the United States rural population lacks broadband access. In Iowa, it's 19%, but 19% is still too many, and we have some outliers. So this system, while it does take adjustment, change is always difficult, but it does actually increase the fairness of the system so that Mr. Schultz can reach rural consumers and businesses all over the state.
Mm-hmm. I neglected to mention that Brian Schultz, you are a member of the Partner Communications Cooperative Advisory Board, in addition to being there, the founder and owner of Opposable Thumbs in State Center.
That's correct.
Okay. Let's talk about, because most of our, this is a good concrete example when we look at what's going on in Central Iowa with this area, Partner Communications Cooperative. But I wonder, Mark Wigfield, can you tell us how our listeners statewide are going to notice any difference under this new rule, city dwellers versus rural inhabitants?
The Connect America Fund is targeted for rural America, and its purpose is to connect all of rural America to broadband. So the fastest change that we'll see is in this quick infusion of funds that was provided to CenturyLink across the state. That's $1.9 million to build out to 2,400 locations. That's roughly, over 60, it's about 6,500 people. But as we go forward into the second phase next year, for these larger companies, broadband deployment is a actually requirement of getting support. For the smaller companies, we make it, we're a little more lenient because they may have sparsely populated areas, but we make it a very clear expectation that they provide it. So I think we're going to see, more broadband deployment going forward. And we believe that actually the mechanisms we put in place are more certain, even in today's economy, than the status quo. In other words, certain revenues that the small companies have been relying on have been in decline over the years. We've actually set forward a system that is stable and predictable. So we feel that it actually gives them more knowledge of what will come down the line. Obviously, everyone is scrambling to understand how to best to implement these rules, but we think we put in place a rational system that will enable carriers to have a steady revenue stream so they can invest.
Yes, very involved, complicated rules, also for our discussion purposes. Don, it's clear that you're not pleased with the change from the Universal Service Fund to the Connect America Fund. Do you recognize anything that was wrong with the Universal Service Fund? What would be best for you now?
Well, I think the nature of our rural companies and the changes that were put forth with the intercarrier compensation and USF reforms subject to review. One example would be a regression formula process where they do a mathematical analysis of your cost and then you're capped at certain levels for receiving universal service. Again, using the word cap, that means it's historical. It means this plant that's already in the ground and that really doesn't give you incentive or ability to capitalize and fund future construction. And, we go back to the Telecom Act of 1996, and it talks about, providing a sustainable and predictable environment for rural telecom under the rules of the Telecom Act. And I really feel like this order has overstepped those bounds, and we just need to step back and take a second look at where we're at in the process. NARUC is the National Utility Commission's commissioners around the country, their association. They've recently filed comments with the FCC. Again, let's stop the process, step back, take a look at it, and see what we need to do to evaluate the impact currently and then what steps need to be taken to move forward.
Mark Wigfield, any wiggle room there? Any room for revision, or is this the way it's going to be according to the FCC?
Well, we are always in dialogue with, with consumers, with carriers, and obviously we work, the goal is to deploy broadband to all America. The goal is for all consumers to have access to phone service and broadband. So obviously we continue, we have an open door, and we have a process that accommodates input. But I think it's a mistake to say that, we need to stop. These reforms have been called for over a decade from both, in Congress on both sides of the aisle, among rural Americans, among urban Americans. And so it's important that we move forward. And in fact, these reforms are mild. As I mentioned before, Iowa carriers essentially see a slight increase over the next 2 years in support. And they have a more predictable mechanism for understanding what their revenues are going to be. We have a way now to try to rein in excess spending so that when you pay your phone bill and you pay your universal service charge, you know that you're not funding somebody's gold-plated network or dividends to shareholders out of your money. So we do need to have some fiscal restraint on this fund, which means having reasonable ways to compare costs and look at the costs. Providing stability and support for investment, but not letting people walk away with the store.
Okay, we've got very short of time. Don Jennings, very quick words, if you have anything to point to make still.
Well, we recently completed a study at the ITA in regards to financial performance of rural telecom companies in Iowa, and the average rate of return in a lot of cases is under 2% rate of return. So, you know, Iowa's rural companies aren't bankrolling the money. They're putting it in infrastructure. It's one network. Wireless needs wired network, and we're committed to building that out, but we must have a fair and equitable, predictable revenue stream.
Okay, Mark Wigfield, the last word to you, perhaps on the importance of broadband.
Certainly. I mean, broadband is important really in almost every facet of life. If you're a small business owner, you want to be able to reach those national and global markets. If you're a student, you need to get online to do your homework. If you are in a community, you want to be able to communicate, you know, in the most efficient way with your neighbors. So it's important that it be there. It's important that everyone have it, and it's important that we have a rational system that is fair to everyone, so that we don't have, some counties where you have 65% unserved and some areas with none. So.
There's our point of agreement, gentlemen. Broadband is important to everyone. Mark Wigfield, spokesperson for the Federal Communications Commission, thank you for joining us. Don Jennings and Brian Schultz, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us as well.
Thank you. Right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry and Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Jeff Schmidt, who is the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.